Eh bien, mesdames, messieurs, chers collègues, permettez-moi évidemment d'abord d'exprimer ma gratitude à Samantha Besson pour son accueil et au Collège de France également. I have 15 minutes to launch the panel discussion. We are a little bit ahead of time. I'm not going to take more than 15 minutes. And I'm going to make comments, as I was asked to do, on four very rich papers, and you've heard those papers right now and before the break. Before the break, Professor Hollis asked, do international agreements have a consent problem? And his rich and settled paper argues that in relation to international agreements more generally, and not just treaties, he argues that consent fulfills three functions. You remember, he identified those three functions: consent as commitment, which relates to the very existence of an agreement; consent as content of the agreement; consent as constitution for the possibility of agreements. And the paper spells out these functions and suggests that international law might explore mandating different formalities for consent's different functions. It is frankly difficult to disagree with those propositions, as they simply offer a new way, a very fruitful way, I think, to look at rather uncontroversial legal realities. Consent is indeed both prevalent across the functions associated with international agreements and polysemous, as Duncan puts it. I'm, however, less sure about the proposal he makes at page 19 of his paper to, I quote, flip the script between consent and content and use the latter to delineate the former. Indeed, I don't see how content dictates consent, to use his words, except in very specific circumstances, notably state succession to borders being the most obvious one. However, in such a case, consent is not really at play. Rather, bindingness is grounded in the effect of a customary rule, irrespective of the absence of consent as commitment. However, if by content dictates consent, we mean that it is always in light of the content of an agreement that consent as commitment is given or declined, then of course such pretty straightforward proposition is simply descriptive of the rational choices that are supposedly at play when consenting to an agreement. Professor Sarbiev paper addresses the second function of consent brought to light by Professor Hollis, that is, consent to the normative content of treaties. And he argues, you've heard him, he argues that the current law of treaties is premised in a theory of meaning that is inhospitable to substantive consensualism. This is because, he says, deciphering the intention of the parties plays a marginal role for the purpose of treaty interpretation. And Fouad laments about such situation, or rather, he does not really believe that common intent is ever out of the picture. Expelled through the door by Article 31 and 32, common intent always creeps back through the window at a certain point, while exciting common intent opens up an unpredictable interpretative space. He might be right in the sense that common intent is always indeed looming large when arguing about the meaning of treaties, but I would like here to speak in support of the rules on treaty interpretation as codified in the Vienna Convention. So, like Zemanek, that he referred to on a slide, like Zemanek, I do fail students when they foolishly refer to common intention as the compass and purpose of treaty interpretation. Using the distinctions made by Duncan Hollis, I would simply say that content as commitment, which is the first function of content he identified, or content as form, to use the words used this morning by Jean d'Apremont, I would say that content as commitment or content as form is dependent, that is function of consent as content. As I just recalled, it is pretty unquestionable that states consent to treaties in light of their content. But if that is the case, and that is obviously the case, then I submit that the rules on treaty interpretation do well in not referring to common intent of states, except in the specific circumstance recalled by Article 31, paragraph 4. Why? Why is it so? Well, I'm afraid that the answer is pretty down-to-earth and commonsensical. There's no much need of any theory here. The VCLT, the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, rules on treaty interpretation are what they are simply because that is the only way to take consent as commitment seriously and to allow, let alone encourage, on a fair and sound basis, accession to multilateral treaties by states that did not take part in their negotiations and drafting. Indeed, what do those states know about the intention of the drafters when they ponder on whether to join or not an existing treaty that may have been concluded, negotiated and concluded long before that same state came into being? The acceding state must be able to trust the text of the treaty as it stands in light of its object and stated purpose. Treaty accession would be a fool's game if, after becoming a treaty, a new state to the treaty could be told by an original party, aha, you thought that Article 4 or Article 6 meant this, but you are wrong. It means something completely different. And here is the evidence, based on the exchange of diplomatic notes that I had with the other negotiating parties at the time of the drafting. The good faith of the acceding state would be surprised, would be defeated, if joint intention were the cornerstone of treaty interpretation. In other words, the only way to preserve equality, and I remember Samantha Besson this morning spoke about equality, the only way to preserve equality between parties within a treaty when acceding that treaty is possible without having negotiated that treaty, the only way of preserving equality is to do as Article 31 and 32 suggest. No privileged position of any contracting party, as Professor Zarbiev said. Requiring that the common intention be the alpha and omega of treaty interpretation is giving an advantage to some parties over others, as the travaux are not always published or accessible, or not always consulted before acceding a treaty. The joint intention can only be the one of the drafters, but the drafters are not to be confused with the parties. That is why common intention is not suitable as the commanding principle of treaty interpretation. As Alain Pellet said, consenting is not willing, and the common intention or will of the original parties is not opposable to the later acceding parties, despite, or rather because, of their consent as commitment. So, and here the first two papers intersect. So if you take consent as commitment seriously, consent as content cannot be determined in light of the intention of the drafters. Also, if you want to promote world governance through treaties, you can only end up with treaty interpretation rules that do not require to search for the intent of the drafters. At best, you can say that the drafters are supposed to have made their intention clear in the text of the treaty, and that text stands in light of as that text stands in light of the object and purpose of the treaty. But such type of presumption is only there to defeat any argument based on common intent that would be raised afterwards. The text is what the acceding states see when they envisage
joining the treaty, and they are entitled to take that text seriously as it stands and for what it is and what it says. In other words, there is a public interest in determining content as specified by Article 31 and 32, eventually disregarding original intent, which by definition is not opposable to newcomers. Treaties are living instruments first and foremost because of others, because of the fact that others may join. And this makes treaties open to accession very different, I submit, very different from contracts. Have you ever seen a contract where third parties may join? Now, of course, a treaty might also be a living instrument in a very different way. And that happens when a court, having compulsory jurisdiction under that treaty, feels authorized to very creatively develop it. In such a case, reading the treaty is, of course, not sufficient to know what obligation will be binding on you once you joined. Obviously, it would be professional malpractice to counsel a state to simply read the European Convention on Human Rights before acceding it. But that is a different matter. And the Strasbourg Court and the instrument it is the guardian of should not be viewed as the standard model of international law. Standard international law kicks back in when it comes to exiting, withdrawing, which might indeed be put on the table politically when interpretation is not simply a stretch, but actually, and quite frankly, a leap that is pretty difficult to justify in light of the words of the convention, not in light of the intention of the drafters. Now, maybe you'll also say that I might have a point about multilateral treaties, but not about bilateral treaties, which very much look like contracts, and where the search for the drafter's intent should, a contrario, be dominant. However, as we know, the Vienna Convention rules on treaty interpretation make no distinction between bilateral or multilateral treaties. Why? Maybe because bilateral treaties may become binding by succession on states that did not negotiate them. If legal stability is worth being pursued and therefore opting in to be encouraged, then again the rules of Article 31 and 32 make full sense, while the search for the common intent of the drafters would strongly discourage the successor state to agreeing remaining bound by the treaties concluded by the state to which it succeeds. And of course, this is an entirely different situation from the question of succession to borders I referred to earlier. This being said, situations of state succession remain exceptional and should not be a prevailing consideration when thinking about rules on treaty interpretation. In that regard, it must be noted that it is mostly in bilateral treaties that reference is made to the need to respect the intention of the parties. And that makes more sense. I concede. I agree. Opposing to one party both parties' original intent is fair in a bilateral context because it cannot come as a surprise to any of the parties. And the bilateral San Juan River case, to which Professor Zarbieff referred in relation to generic terms, is the case I'd point. Be that as it may, Fuad builds his argument on the following apparently logical proposition when discussing the rule exception relationship between paragraph 1 and 4 of Article 31. And I refer to his written contribution at page 9. I quote him: "If a special meaning is to be given to a term when the parties so intended, which is what Article 31, paragraph 4 says, it can only be so because a term is to be given whatever meaning the parties intended to give it. If this is so," he writes, "both paragraph 1 and paragraph 4 are particular applications of such a general rule. Paragraph 1 is based on the presumption that the parties ordinarily intend to use treaty terms in their ordinary meaning. And paragraph 4 covers situations in which the presumption of ordinary meaning is rebutted. End of quote. The logic of this proposition seems unassailable, as he writes. However, I submit that paragraph 4 does not confirm that paragraph 1 is based on the presumption of intent through ordinary meaning, or rather, I submit that such presumption is actually immaterial. Paragraph 1 is based on an obligation to interpret treaties according to the ordinary meaning of the terms in their context and in light of the object and purpose of the treaty, not so much because there would be an underlying presumption that the ordinary meaning of the terms reflects the drafter's intent, but because good faith and consent as commitment, taken seriously, require such interpretative obligation. What is at stake here, as Samantha so eloquently said in her introduction, what is at stake here is the tension between treaties as contracts and treaties as instruments of collective governance. When treaties are used in the context of climate change, and I turn now to Jutta's Brunet's paper, collective governance, of course, is at issue. The paper, as you heard, very clearly traces back the consent issue in the UNFCCC convention, in the Kyoto Protocol, and in the Paris Agreement. The novelty of the Paris Agreement is its bottom-up approach through the NDCs, the nationally determined contributions. Although NDCs are not legally binding, preparing, communicating, and maintaining an NDC is an obligation under the Paris Agreement. You just heard it. Consent is here given to an undetermined content that each state is called to specify and determine by itself in light of a collective objective. The process creates the content, and the process is there only to encourage and receive self-determined restrictions relating to carbon emission. As Jutta Brunet shows, less law is designed here to mean more and faster results, while under the Paris Agreement, consent is essentially located at the national level. In a way, consent as content is imminent. It is not transcended and sealed by an instrument with a fixed content common to all parties. The model resulting from the Paris Agreement is no doubt unsettling for lawyers more accustomed to see consent subordinated to substantive content, and who consider that the absence of real, hard content is not really worth consenting. And that consent, given in such circumstances, is somewhat cheap. Inventive diplomats and activists, hopefully, beg to differ, and they may be right. Actually, the row about the US walking away from the Paris Agreement under the Trump administration proves they are right. The Paris Agreement is no cheap consent. And as Jutta Brunet argued, the shift it operates accounts for enhanced domestic democratic legitimacy. And finally, I turn to Laurence Boisson-Chazourne's paper on consent in investment arbitration. Again, you just heard the paper, very clear and convincing paper that in many ways ties also back to Christian Tam's presentation this morning. My remarks can be very brief. First, the paper discusses whether preconditions to arbitration are a matter of jurisdiction or admissibility. Laurence did not speak much about this issue except when she referred to Brigitte Stern's dissent. But the paper does indeed refer to the 2010 judgment in Georgia v. Russia, and the judgment, in my opinion, settles indeed the issue. Preconditions are jurisdictional. In other words, when it comes to compromissory clauses, content is inseparable from consent and vice versa. And this leads me to my second point, The paper discusses at length, and you heard Laurence in a very lively way introducing us to those judicial arbitral debates, the discussion of, about the use of the MFN clauses to import preferable jurisdictional condition. The paper, you heard Laurence also, is critical of such import, and I think rightly so. In that discussion, maybe it could be interesting to refer to the resolution adopted by the Institut de droit international in 2013 at the Tokyo session, Andrea Giardina being rapporteur. The resolution does not change much about the outcome that Laurence spoke about. The resolution is about investment arbitration and contains an Article 12, but the resolution is typical, I think, of the wrong focus of the debate. The Article 12 reads as follows. Most favorite nation treatment requires interpretation of the specific wording of the clause of the treaty in which it is inserted in order to respect the intentions of the state parties. There you go. This is of particular significance when MFN clause is claimed to encompass dispute settlement provisions. What is striking in this provision is not so much that reference is made to the intentions of the state parties, and Fouad Zarbieff will probably like that, that intention is referred to. But again, we are very much in the realm of bilateral treaties, and the MFN clause, as a clause de renvoi, allows to jump from one bilateral treaty to another bilateral treaty, importing then the intention of one of the parties with a third one in the original treaty where the MFN clause is incorporated. Rather, what is striking is that the import of most favorable conditions for jurisdictional purposes through the MFN clause is deemed to be an issue of interpretation of the MFN clause itself, rather than of the arbitration clause. And that is the focus, I think, that is questionable. Of course, the MFN clause is relevant. And of course, its terms may be relevant and may eventually prevent any jurisdictional import. But the governing provision of jurisdiction remains the compromissory clause itself, or the absence of compromissory clause, not the MFN clause. In that regard, and that's maybe we'll have a chat about this, Laurence, later on. In that regard, I think that the debate about the effect of the MFN clauses for jurisdictional purposes could gain from drawing from the basic principle of the autonomy or severability of the jurisdictional or arbitrational clause. As is well known, compétence de la compétence commands to consider a compromissory clause as an agreement independent of the other terms of the treaty. And I refer you to article, for instance, Article 21 of the PCA optional rules, or the ICAO Council judgment of 1972 of the ICJ. Obviously, if there is a claim of termination of the treaty to defeat jurisdiction, there is never jurisdiction to determine if that is so. And the Croatia-Slovenia partial award of 2016 is the case at point. But if that is the case, the determination of jurisdiction in such a situation could certainly not be made on the basis of the import through the MFN clause of more favorable conditions, since the MFN clause is a substantive provision that might be terminated when jurisdiction is determined. But if importing favorable terms through the MFN clause is not possible, then why would the same jurisdictional clause mean something different in a different setting, that is when the MFN clause is not terminated? Ladies and gentlemen, in jurisdictional matters, and as Christian rightly said this morning, consent is very special. And the existence of consent is a legal question that cannot be separated from its specific material scope and conditions. Existence of consent and content of consent is then one and the same thing. And as Christian also showed, substantive content is here simply the opening up of a process with uncertain outcome. I shall leave it here, thanking again very warmly all panelists for their great papers that we shall discuss now. And I give back the floor to all panelists. Thank you very much for your attention.